G. To get copies of today's program, Chris Hedges on What the Genocide Says About Us, and for his latest book, War is the Greatest Evil, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Palestine Center for Public Policy. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
And this is FM 90.1, KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Revolution starts right now. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. This is Sue Hildebrand. The Real Issue is a weekly public affairs program. We are here every Wednesday night from 6 until 7 p.m. This edition of The Real Issue is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Edible Shasta Butte, celebrating the abundance of the North State season by season since 2007. Edible Shasta Butte is a quarterly magazine sharing in the edible community's goal to connect consumers with family farmers, chefs, and food artisans of all kinds. Edible Shasta Butte is available from Butte County to the Oregon border and online at edibleshastabutte.com. So tonight on The Real Issue, we will first get an update from Chris Honey, Executive Director at the California Budget and Policy Center, about the projected multi-billion dollar budget shortfall right here in the state of California, what the governor and the legislature have already done, and what our legislative leaders must do to pass a balanced budget by the middle of June. Then we'll talk with Butte County Supervisor Tammy Ritter about the county's regulations around cannabis and why she wants the Board of Supervisors to reevaluate the policies and procedures involved in illegal grows in the county areas. So let's just begin. Let's jump right in with the California state budget. Back in January, the executive director of the California Budget and Policy Center gave us an overview of the projected budget shortfall of somewhere between $38 billion and $68 billion. The discrepancy in the estimates depended on who you asked. So since that time, the governor and the legislative leaders agreed upon some budget cuts, some delays in spending, and even a few accounting gimmicks, totaling a reduction in the spending of over $17 billion to address the projected shortfall so that a balanced budget can be passed by the constitutional deadline of mid-June. I do have on the phone with me back once again, Chris Honey of the California Budget and Policy Center. Thanks again for coming back and giving us an update.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Sue.
So Chris, the budget stuff is not an exact science, and as I mentioned, there was an estimate of somewhere between $38 and $68 billion, and the idea was a better number would not be known until after tax day, which was of course last week. But earlier this month, before we go to the tax day stuff, earlier this month, Governor Newsom signed legislation that would reduce the budget spending for this upcoming fiscal cycle by $17 billion, which included real spending cuts and some delays in the spending. So before we talk about which programs were cut, give us an update on the projected budget shortfall as of right now, as you know it, including that cut in $17 billion that was just passed and signed by the governor.
Yeah, so we're basically still in the same boat we were in back in January, because they still don't really have an accurate picture of what tax collections look like. And while most of us paid our taxes just, a little over a week ago, those numbers are not in yet. So they'll have a clearer picture in the coming days. We're not there yet. But the reality is that, the number hasn't been adjusted. The legislative analyst office thinks it could be as high as $73 billion. The governor's office still thinks it's lower. It all depends on how you measure it, and so much of it actually just depends on what happens with revenue collection. So the unfortunate answer is we still don't know. one way or another, they have reduced the size of the deficit that the state leaders actually have to solve for over the next 4 to 6 weeks, because they took early action in the last week to reduce, the number in total by taking $17 billion off the table in what amounts to things they knew they were going to have to do. And so they decided to take early action and get those out of the way. And now they have the hard work ahead of them of figuring out the rest of it. And the rest of it is still an unknown number.
So let's talk about that $17 billion in cuts. What was it? What's in that? And I know that there's more than just cuts. There's delays, and there's what a lot of folks are saying, these accounting gimmicks where, you know, moving salaries that would have been paid in June, but accounting for it in July so that it moves into the next fiscal cycle. But talk about the real cuts that we're going to be facing.
Yeah, you know, the cuts are going to really be because what they're doing is basically putting a freeze on spending. So they're basically saying appropriations and allocations that they made in prior budget years, that the money isn't yet out the door and isn't spent yet, that a lot of that money can be frozen in the meantime until they have a better idea of the overall picture. And so we don't know exactly what that means for specific programs, because there isn't like readily available information that tells you that this program's money hasn't been spent yet, this other program's money has been. And they may not actually have to report on that program by program, unfortunately. So it's kind of hard to say where the cuts are going to come. But there are going to be some freezes of prior plan spending. I think most of that is going to be in one-time spending. So during the surplus years back in 2020, 2021, 2022, there was a lot of one-time funding when they had those surpluses on things like infrastructure, climate programs, workforce programs. And I think those one-time expenditures, if they're not out the door, are probably most vulnerable. Ongoing programs like education, higher education, safety net services, I think are more protected. So I think it's more the like new stuff and the one-time stuff that they did that's actually on the table to be delayed or suspended as part of this early action.
So, Chris Koenig, years ago, I lived in Arizona, and I worked for Arizona state government for a few years. And that was sort of, as we got to the end of the fiscal cycle, everybody was trying to figure out what they could spend money on, because if they didn't spend their budget, then the next year's budget would be cut. And so it was that you know, the end of the year cycle of, oh my God, who needs what? And let's just get it out the door. And it sounds like that's good strategy if you don't want your budget cut this time. So is that kind of what you're saying, is people that had a budget but hadn't quite spent it yet, that was going to be pulled back?
Yes, I think that's the idea. Although I think, you know, basically now that the governor and the legislature have taken action, that kind of activity really can't happen any major scale, because they're basically, they've issued, you know, a statement in essence to state agencies saying, you know, stop spending those things you can stop spending on, that we're authorizing you to stop spending on. So, you know, I don't think you're going to see a tremendous amount of like rush to spend a whole bunch of money quickly. I think that verdict on that is done. But I don't want to oversell it. I mean, I think most programs and services that are kind of core to what the state does are pretty much protected in various ways by formulas and by schedules by which the money goes out. So it's not like the average person in the state is going to see a dramatic change in services. I think it's more going to be the new things that state leaders put on the table that they wanted to do over the last few years, where, you know, they're developing a new way to deliver the funding. They're developing a new program. Sometimes that takes a lot of time. It's a big and complicated state. I think those kinds of investments are the ones that are most vulnerable to being delayed or deferred or frozen kind of indefinitely until they know more.
Right. Right. No, I wasn't suggesting everybody was going to go on a big spending frenzy. No, I was just thinking back in the days when we got towards the end of the fiscal year, I remember my director would come around and say, we got money in the budget. What do you want?
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, yeah. I hear you. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have the executive director of the California Budget and Policy Center, Chris Honey, here on the phone with me. Talking about the latest, the latest update on the projected multi-billion-dollar budget deficit, and this new budget needs to be balanced and passed by mid-June. So, Chris Honey, I know you mentioned that we're not really going to know how much the deficit could be until after, you know, the numbers have come in. But tax day was last week, and the numbers are starting to roll in. Do you have an estimate? I mean, is the state sort of, on pace with what was projected, or is it lower than expected? Is it higher than expected? Or is it just like, really, we just don't know yet?
I wish I could be more certain about it. I think the answer is we don't know. I think there are two competing indicators right now. I think one thing that's happening is the state does get to get a picture of how the monthly revenue collections are going from the personal income tax, the tax we all pay on the wages and salaries that we make. And the monthly collections have been coming in slightly below projections for a couple of months this year and then slightly above. And so it's kind of hard to say, you know, maybe not far off, but that's kind of based on withholding from our paychecks, right? The state taxes that are withheld from our paychecks. The taxes that we all paid in April, earlier this month, and the estimated tax payments that people pay who actually tend to owe money on an annual basis, which tends to be wealthier people, more well-off households, those tend to pick up the capital gains and the other big drivers of the state's revenues. And those are much harder to predict. So like in terms of the taxes that we're all paying, those are looking sort of not too far off from projections, but we don't know yet what April looks like because 2023 was a pretty good year economically. The stock market did pretty well. Mm-hmm. So there's some surmising that we could actually see a more significant increase in revenue collections than we might have projected earlier. And that would help state leaders with the overall deficit. But there's just so much about the stock market and how people register that in terms of their taxes. It's really unknown. Like I would hesitate to make any kind of prediction. I'm hopeful that it will be more likely to be better than worse, but there's been so much with the economy over the last few years between the pandemic, interest rates, inflation, et cetera. It's kind of hard to predict anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I mentioned in the beginning, this is not an exact science. So Chris Honey, let's move on to what is going to have to happen. Even, you know, the governor's office predicted $38 billion deficit. And that's best case scenario in terms of the numbers that we're talking about. The LAO, the Legislative Affairs Office, puts it at much higher. But let's say $38 billion and the legislature identified $17 billion. Best case scenario, if things sort of move relatively along as the governor may hope, we're still out $21 billion. What do you think our legislative leaders need to do in order to find that money and pass a balanced budget by the middle of June?
Yeah, I think state legislative leaders and the governor have said they really want to do the best they can to protect the progress that they've made over the last decade. We've had over a decade of economic growth, and that's meant the revenues have been growing, and they've been putting some of those revenues into programs and then putting other revenues into reserves. Some of those reserves are actually a part of the way that they will solve this budget deficit, so they will draw down the reserves, and the early action they've already taken uses a portion of those reserves. I think from there, what they have to do is decide if there's a mix of revenues and spending that they're going to pull back on that solves the rest of the equation. And they're very reluctant to look at revenues, unfortunately. I think there are things they could do that would pull back tax breaks for, say, corporations and wealthy households that would actually produce revenue, that would make the tax code more fair, wouldn't significantly harm the well-being of those corporations and households that are affected, and would help them avoid having to make cuts. And if they're not willing to do that, then they're actually going to have to make some cuts in programs and services to solve what will likely be, you know, whether it's $21 billion or it's $30 billion or some number north of there. Mm-hmm. they'll have to make some cuts. The overall state budget is about $300 billion in size, so I know that $20 billion or $30 billion sounds like a big number, and it is, but it's also important to keep it in scale, that it's sort of like, you know, 10% or a little more than 10% of the state budget. So that means they're going to have to go to certain places where they have control and make some cuts to get through the next fiscal year if they don't want to do anything about revenues.
Right. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. Chris Honey, Executive Director at the California Budget and Policy Center, is on the phone with me. So Chris, you mentioned, I mean, in the last few years, we have seen during the pandemic, ironically, state budget was the state government had these crazy surpluses, and the governor and the legislature put this extra money into various programs in order, you know, about to protect against wildfire, for example, and deal with the climate crisis and so on. And so it sounds like what you're saying is, what could be the result is that we don't see a lot of change. You know, like we're not going to go backwards. On the other hand, we're not going to continue forward. If everything goes, you know, if the worst case scenario is not that bad, we might not see the progress in terms of addressing the various crises happening in our state, but we might not actually see a reduction in services. Is that true? Could that possibly happen?
Yes, I think what you're going to see state leaders try and do is basically try to reduce the human impact of whatever cuts they have to make. Recognizing that low and middle income households in the state that are largely struggling with, a state that has mostly a high cost of living in most regions, you know, that they don't want to take cash out of those people's pockets, and they don't want to take services away that are in lieu of cash, like food assistance or child care support or even education services. And so I think they're going to try to protect those core vital services that help people get by on a day-to-day basis. I think the places where you're going to see them pull back are going to be these multi-year investments that they were trying to make in things like climate adaptation, catching up on infrastructure needs, unfortunately, one-time investments they were trying to make to catch up on things like helping build a larger behavioral health workforce, a public health workforce, which we know was a real gap during the pandemic. Some of those kinds of one-time investments that they were trying to make over the last few years, I think that's where the pullback is going to come. And those are going to have impacts too. You know, I want to be clear, we have infrastructure needs in the state. Climate adaptation needs are clear. It's just that those are kind of out-year, multi-year investments that they were trying to make. And I think they feel like they have to pull back on those in order to protect, like, not taking cash out of people's pockets.
Right. That makes sense. That absolutely makes sense. Chris, I have just two more questions for you. They're kind of meaty, but I think you're so good at this, you can answer them, I think, relatively quickly. So as I was, you know, kind of following along, I was reading about the $17 billion legislation to, you know, to start taking action on reducing the budget deficit for next year. You know, one of the criticisms is that there's a lot of accounting gimmicks, which I don't necessarily see it as a gimmick if you have to balance the budget and you can push off costs, even if they're just on paper, into the following year. But the problem with that is just pushing off some of the costs to the following fiscal year, there's prediction that this kind of budget shortfall is going to happen for many years to the state of California. What do you think about this assessment? And if you agree with it, why?
So I think it all depends on whether this is a multi-year problem or if this is a temporary problem that we're dealing with. So if it's a temporary problem, and the one thing we do know is that the reason the state budget deficit that we have is there now is 2022 as a tax year was a down year overall for the stock market and the economy. And so the state's revenues are reflecting that. And that's what's driving the deficit. We know 2023 was better. 2024 has been significantly better. So if that suggests this is a temporary problem, then some of these maneuvers where they shift costs from one fiscal year to the next are a smart way and a good budgeting way of not making cuts to vital programs and services and just moving the money around on paper to a year when things will be better. Mm-hmm. If we're in a multi-year problem, then shifting those costs to the next fiscal year is just kicking the can down the road. And so here again, this really comes down to, like, what are we going to learn about revenue projections in the next couple weeks? Mm-hmm. And by the time the governor releases his budget in May, and what does that tell us about the next couple of years? It's a gamble. I just want to say we're not going to know with any certainty about that in terms of what it looks like for the next year and the year afterward for a while. And so, it could be a totally appropriate measure for them to have used. It could also end up making their lives harder.
Sure.
With future budget deficits.
Yep. Chris Honey, here's my very last question for you. It's one I almost always ask you. And just to kind of set it up is, you know, I read a lot about, the criticism. Assembly member James Gallagher is my assembly member. And so it's kind of interesting to be able to say, oh, I know that. Well, I don't know the guy, but, you know, I sort of follow the guy, and he is the minority leader in the assembly. He's a very vocal critic of the governor, and he is squarely blaming the giant budget deficit on the governor. But the reality is the wild fluctuations in the state budget is a perennial problem because of the structure of our revenue. If you could do one thing, what would you change so that we could have a more predictive revenue stream, if that's possible?
So the reason that we have a less predictable revenue stream is because our state's voters have said consistently for decades that they want a tax system that says that the more you make, the more you pay. And that's our take on fairness in California when it comes to taxes. That is going to produce volatility because the highest income earners usually make those their earnings off of things like stock market gains and capital gains and the like. Those go up and down with every change in the economy, and so it creates volatility. Out of that, the state gets more revenue than it would have done, and it does so on a more fair basis. So you don't really want to change that, because the alternative is you make less money, you have less revenue to put into vital programs and services, and you're asking low-income people to pay more and middle-income people to pay more. So the answer is actually how you then solve for that on the spending side. And I think the one thing I would like to see the state be able to do is actually budget on a multi-year basis in an official way. I think they do a lot of it behind the scenes. But I would like them to, rather than having to pass a budget in a big surplus year that's just for that year, be able to say, oh, that surplus isn't going to be there 2 or 3 years from now. We're going to pass a 3-year budget that smooths out the overall cycle. And that would mean we wouldn't have these wild fluctuations that they have to deal with in these arbitrary dates, the way they're having you do now.
Right. To deal with a budget that's $300 billion is tough to negotiate from year to year. So, as always, Chris Honey, you are always, it's always enlightening to talk with you, and it's always so interesting. And as always, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. We will stay up to date on the budget.
Thanks, Sue. I appreciate it.
All righty. We are going to take a really quick break, and we'll be back because I have Butte County Supervisor Tammy Ritter just walked into the studio, so we are definitely going to make some time for her. Don't go away. We will be right back. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR. Money, 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 money. Money. We are back. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. This is Sue Hildebrand. We turn now to the issue of cannabis in Butte County. Now, you may be thinking that there is no issue around cannabis now that it is legal, right? But I mean, really, how badly could it be in terms of regulating a legal product? Well, we're going to talk about just how badly it currently is being regulated. So now, as many folks here in Butte County know, California voters approved Prop 64 back in 2016, allowing adult use of medical and recreational marijuana. Right here in Butte County, like all counties, there are regulations about how much someone can grow for their personal use and lots of regulations for larger cultivation. Here in Butte County, growing cannabis is a land use issue, and the county only gets involved when there is a complaint filed. Once there is a complaint, the process gets a bit wacky. Here in the studio with me is Butte County Supervisor Tammy Ritter, who has been frustrated with the process for years now and has finally gotten a majority of the Board of Supervisors to agendize the issue on a future meeting. I am, as always, happy to have you on The Real Issue, but even happier today because you're right here in the studio with me, Supervisor.
Thanks for having me.
So give us some background. What are the county regulations for growing cannabis on private land?
So if you own a parcel that is less than 5 acres, you may grow up to 6 plants, but you have to do it inside the structure, inside the residence that is built on that property. If you live on a property that is more than 5 acres, you still can only grow 6 plants, but now you can grow it inside or you can grow it outside. So that's the flexibility you get. If there's no residence on the property, you are not allowed to grow any amount of plants. If there is not a water source, such as a well, you are not allowed to grow. And your grow is not allowed to be visible, you know, kind of from the property line or where somebody else could see it.
And so we don't need to spend, you know, the whole conversation here about, you know, why all of these regulations exist. But some of them do seem a little hard to follow. Like, I do understand you need a water source because if you're growing, you got to have water and, you know, you don't want to be stealing somebody else's water, that kind of thing. But this thing about if it's more than 5 acres, you can have inside-outside grows.
Inside or
inside
outside.
Or outside. But if you have less than 5 acres, it can only be
inside. And then there's a lot of rules about ventilation and the smell and filtration and things like that, because with a parcel size of less than 5 acres, they don't want the smell of it to drift over to a neighbor's property.
Uh-huh. And, you know, and I get that. I do want to point out, though, that I live right near Sierra Nevada Brewery, and every week I always know when they're brewing.
Yep.
Because it always smells like hot dogs.
Yep.
It reminds me of hot dogs. And I sort of say, ooh, that's stinky, but, you know.
I think it smells like SpaghettiOs, but yeah, I hear you. I think there were hot dogs in SpaghettiOs.
I think you're right. Okay, so now we've got these rules mm-hmm. and regulations, and it's pretty normal. It's not like it's a legal product, so anybody can do it. I mean, everything is regulated just so that we can live in community. But let's talk about the next thing is the county doesn't ever enforce any of these rules. They're not coming to, you know, there's not an enforcement person that comes and checks on your grow or, you know, we all have our privacy, except when there's a complaint. So somebody files a complaint with the county and then says, I think this person is violating the local regulations. Talk about why a complaint-driven policy is a problem.
Well, here's why I think it's a major problem, is that if you look at the properties that we are doing these abatements on, and you go on Google Earth and you look at it from an aerial view, it's not an isolated grow. What you see is that there are, you know, a dozen grows around it, a dozen hoop houses or a dozen properties with hoop houses. And so who is calling in that complaint? What neighbor is calling in that complaint? Is it one of the other growers because they don't want this competition? Is it because this person has a large water truck that's coming down the road too often? Is it because they're siphoning off the creek? Is it because they've noticed that this person's trellising or using chemicals? We don't know who the complaining party is. And not only is Butte County not going out and saying, oh, let's see if we can find some violations, when they are responding to the property that has been complained about, and they are driving past all of these properties that there are visual, obvious violations, we don't do anything about those.
Mm.
We only address the property that had the complaint filed. And the objective comes from a really good place, right? When we have a complaint-driven process, The idea is that we're trying to get people to come into compliance so that we don't have to fine people or fee or send it to court or make it a civil court issue. But that's not what happens. Is, you know, we do have some people who they get a 3-day notice to abate, and they do. They either abate or they come in and they talk to our development services and they enter into a plan to abate. But the ones that we're seeing are the folks who either never respond or they show up to this first initial hearing.
Well, let's get into that. I want to just sort of lay out the foundation here. So it's complaint driven, and I eventually want to get back to, if the complaint driven is a problem, then what is the solution? What's the alternative? But let's not go there yet. If there's a complaint, then what happens?
If there's a complaint, then code enforcement goes out, they investigate the complaint, they say, yep, there's 100 plants here. They post at the entrance to that property, they mail the same document that this property is out of compliance and needs to come into compliance, and they have 72 hours to do so. And if they don't, right, then they're going to have to go before a hearing officer. And the hearing officer is going to decide, based on the photographs taken by our code enforcement and, you know, documentation, whether or not a nuisance exists or not. And then when that officer of the courts, essentially, it's a kind of a rotating judge position, says, yes, this nuisance exists, then it goes to the Board of Supervisors. And what we do is we listen to all of the evidence that was presented to the hearing officer, as well as what is now accumulated in fines and assessments and additional fees. The cost of the hearing officer, all of those things are charged to the person who owns the property.
And just for some clarity, when you say a nuisance, you're talking about a violation of the local ordinance.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And so we'll see, you know, sometimes an $80,000 combination of both the lien and the special assessments that come before us. And what happens is people's properties aren't even worth that much. So this is not a program that, in the first case, has cost recovery, but two, is not an effective deterrent to what we are calling a nuisance.
So that I'm actually writing that down. It's not an effective deterrence based on the fact that you see all, as you said in a Google map, if you're looking from above, you can see all these illegal grows all over the county. And it's not a good effective deterrent. I want to come back to the property or the process of this complaint-driven process that eventually comes to the Board of Supervisor, mm-hmm. which you have a hard time with. But let me ask you this. You're talking about a deterrence of people just growing whatever they want. It is a legal plant. What is the problem, Supervisor Ritter, with people just being able to grow whatever they want on their property?
Well, I mean, this is where we kind of butt up against our freedoms, right? It's my property. I should be able to grow whatever I want. And I do believe that to a certain degree. But if what I am growing is being grown by a cartel, or if the neighboring property is being maintained by a cartel, it is certainly increasing the risk for our county in some pretty significant ways. And I'm not necessarily in agreement with a max of 6 plants per person, but the kind of whack-a-mole way that we are addressing complaints and not even verifying if the complaining party is a growing party, you know, is this someone turning in their neighbor because they're competition?
Right.
Right? What we know is that when legalization happened, the price for cannabis dropped drastically, right? And so now we are not seeing as many people who are receiving a nuisance abatement notice working out a deal. So previously, they would, you know, when the cost was higher, they would say, oh, I'm going to harvest in 2 weeks. So this $1,000 a day fine that I'm going to get hit, what's $14,000 if I'm going to make $80,000, right? Now, if they're only making $30,000, that $14,000 is a significant part of their profits. And so I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't know how we manage this as a county, but I think that the way that we're doing now, we have proven over and over and over again, it's not effective. And what's more disturbing to me is that it is not cost effective.
Right, right.
And that's the piece that I have a really big problem with, because this is our county staff. This is ours out of every day that they're spending dealing with these issues. And then it's coming before the Board of Supervisors and they're telling us we're not here to retry the facts of the case. We are only here to discuss the lien and the special assessments.
Well, let's go to that. But let me just say quickly, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have Butte County Supervisor Tammy Ritter right here in the studio with me. Lucky day for me. She's normally on the phone, but it's nice to have her right here in the studio. Supervisor Ritter, let's kind of piece a couple of those data points together. So there's a complaint. We don't know who's complaining. We don't know if the complainer is a grower themselves, but they, you know, complain about their, or maybe they're just mad at their neighbor. Who knows? But there's a complaint. And code enforcement goes out. They notice the land and they say, here, you got to be done here in 72 hours. And then that notification is sent to the address on file.
With the tax assessor's office.
With the tax assessor's office. Here's my question. What if somebody has a piece of land who pays taxes on that land, but they have rented that land for somebody else, to somebody else? They live someplace else, and just like what you're allowed to do with your own personal property is allow somebody to use it while, you know, while you're not using it. Does that assessment go to the landowner or to the grower?
It goes to the landowner. And the position that the county has taken on this over and over and over again is that individuals who own properties must be aware of what is going on their properties. And that if they have someone who is renting their property or a family member who's staying on their property, that that person, if they want to grow, they have to have written permission from the landlord. And then again, it would only be 6 plants. So that's nothing that would ever come before us. So I don't know how many people have those types of letters, but what we hear very often is that people did not receive the notice. So if we have landowners who do not live in Butte County anymore, and we have a lot of them post the fires, what we find is that a lot of them say they did not have notice of the hearing officer. They didn't know that this was going before hearing officer, and they were just informed, you know, before it went to the Board of Supervisors.
So you could, okay, let me start again here. Let me see if I understand this correctly. Maybe I live up in the county. I get burned out. I move away. Mm-hmm. Somebody, let's say somebody is squatting on my land,
yep,
and they are in violation,
yep,
of the county ordinances. And then you don't know that this violation has happened. And then suddenly you get a bill in the mail with all of the assessments that say you now owe the county $20,000.
Yeah, except you wouldn't get a bill because that doesn't get decided until we are in the Board of Supervisors meeting. So you would simply get a notice that your land is in violation.
And then somebody says, wait a minute, I'm not even living there. I'm certainly not growing more than 6 plants on a property that I'm not living on.
Correct.
What do I do now?
Well, you plead with the Board of Supervisors at that point.
So you have to appear in front of the Board of Supervisors,
yep, mm-hmm,
even if you don't live.
Yes.
In this, uh-huh.
Yes. And we have had some referrals to our Adult Protective Services because it was very clear that we had some elderly people who owned property that were being taken advantage of. You know, the individuals who were growing on the property knew that they were not around. And so, you know, we had some folks who didn't speak English and so were not even aware that they had received the violation, only that there was going to be a lien placed on their property. And so there's a lot of different situations, but the tendency is to go back to our chapter 34A and our chapter 34C, which are our ordinances. And what they say is that if you own the property, you are ultimately responsible. And so if you are listed on the tax information, then you are the person who is going to be fined and liened.
Supervisor Ritter, when people come to the board and they say, look, really, I had no idea. I live out of state. I am now having a lien placed on my property. What is their recourse? Is that it?
No. So that's the probably the most just flummoxing part of it all is that if they disagree with whatever ruling the Board of Supervisors makes in a quasi-judicial role, they have to appear and they have to appeal to the Superior Court of Butte County. So I'm not sure why the Board of Supervisors were kind of stuck in the middle of this. We have a judge, a hearing officer, who hears all the facts of the case. And then the Department of Development Services puts together all of the accounting. These are how many hours were spent. These are the hours that it took to get this to a hearing. These are the costs that we need to recover and the penalties. And right. And then they present that to us. Why do they not just present that to the same judge that made a ruling?
And it sounds like there's a lot of expectation for the Board of Supervisors to rubber stamp what has happened earlier.
So I don't think that the expectation is necessarily to rubber stamp it so much as any questions that are raised almost imply that the county code enforcement has done something wrong, which they absolutely have not. In my opinion, I have seen nothing but the highest level of professionalism and them attempting to work with people to get an agreement, you know, abate the property and, they really want to work with people. But any question that we ask during this time that they're hearing about the penalties and the recovery costs and someone saying they weren't noticed, that, of course, brings questions into my mind of, okay, so where did we send the notice?
Yeah, how do we fix this?
Yeah. And so it's not a rubber stamping, in my opinion, but it is not a graceful process. And I think that the process needs to be amended.
And if you are not really to be making any sort of judgment or asking any questions, then why is it coming to you? If the professionals are working on this and the appeal goes to the Superior Court, then why are you all looped into this process? But Supervisor Ritter, you did have this agendized at the meeting the other day. You are going to talk about it in future meetings. And I'm curious, as I've sort of thought about this, I haven't come up with a more elegant, to use your word, I haven't come up with a more elegant process for this, because fundamentally it seems terribly unfair to have to pay the costs for somebody else breaking the rules. Mm-hmm. And it seems terribly unfair that if I own property in Butte County, I have to be basically living on the property. I can't go someplace else because then I'm not constantly overseeing what is happening on my property. You know, that's why you have local rules, right? And it's enforced locally so that I don't have to enforce those rules. That's what the county does.
Right. But in this case,
sure,
what the county is going to say is, this is your property. You own this property. You are responsible for what happens on this property. So I'm not so delusional that I think I'm going to change the mindset.
Sure.
But what I would like to see is a process in place that actually works. So sometimes when we have these hearing officers, people show up with an attorney and they stipulate. And you know what I say to that? Awesome. Great.
Yep.
That is perfect. Because if their attorney showed up and they stipulated to it, then the person either knows that they were in violation of the ordinance or they're willing to take responsibility for it.
Right.
So that's, you know, those aren't as challenging for me. It's the ones where people are saying that they didn't get notice, that they didn't know, where I fear someone's being taken advantage of.
You're right.
Right. And that's the piece that I feel like there has to be a better way. I don't know what it is.
Right.
And I've been looking at what other ordinances other jurisdictions have in place. You know, there's no great solution. I'm definitely open. I'm hoping that I will, after this, your hordes of listeners will be writing me suggestions.
Exactly. You can always write to Supervisor Tammy Ritter in order to give her suggestions on better ways to regulate cannabis grows. And as I say that, Supervisor, I imagine there's folks saying, why are you regulating it? And I kind of want to go back to that question, and particularly I want to talk about, in just the last few minutes that I have with you, I do want to ask you about the environmental effects of these out-of-regulation grows. What are you seeing out there?
So some of the documentation that we've seen is, you know, barrels from chemicals that folks have been using. We see terracing into hillsides and people really just completely denuding the land, clearing just huge areas in order to be able to grow. We have some test wells that they've never been permitted. You know, people took out an initial permit to see if there was water there and then never closed the permit, and people are using those. We've seen siphoning off of creeks. You name it, we've seen it.
And that's one way.
And fire hazards.
And fire hazards.
Yeah.
And fire hazards. So, Supervisor Ritter, I want to ask you, like, what's the solution of all of this? But we have exactly 1 minute left.
And I don't have a solution.
And so when do you think that this might come up for discussion? And are you serious that people can start weighing into the conversation in terms of what are better ways to deal with this?
I would love that. My email is tritter, R-I-T-T-E-R, at buttecounty.net. You can just go on the Board of Supervisors page and you can find us. But I would love to have input because, you know, it's going to have to be a much more creative mind than mine that comes up with a solution to this.
And it's going to have, and while people are thinking about all of these creative ways to do better here in Butte County, we have to keep in mind that the county budget is quite low. Mm-hmm. And so enforcement budgets are very low.
Yep.
And so we do need to have some creative ideas. Did I forget to ask you anything, Supervisor Ritter?
So with that, county budgets are very low. I want to encourage everyone to go onto the buttecounty.net website. On the front page, there is a 7-question survey that you can answer. It has low, medium, and high, talking about what the county priorities are and where you place them. And then there's also a place if you're, you know, issue is not listed in those top 7. You get to write it in a comment box, and we're really wanting as much input as we can possibly get.
And what's that website again?
Buttecounty.net.
Supervisor Tammy Ritter, Butte County Supervisor Tammy Ritter, as always, thanks so much for giving me some of your time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, this brings us to the end of this edition of The Real Issue, which is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Edible Shasta Butte, celebrating the abundance of the North State season by season since 2007. Edible Shasta Butte is a quarterly magazine sharing in the edible community's goal to connect consumers with family farmers, chefs, and food artisans of all kinds. Edible Shasta Butte is available from Butte County to the Oregon border and online at Edible Shasta Butte. All right, this is truly the end of this edition of The Real Issue. We'll be back next week, same time, same station. Until next time, peace out.
Roll another blunt. Yeah. Okay. La da 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 da. La da. La 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la. Yeah. I was gonna clean my room until I got high. I was gonna get up and find the broom, but then I got high. La la, my room is still messed up, and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, cause I got high. Because I got high. Because I got high. La da 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 da. I was gonna go to class before I got high.
Come on, y'all.
Check it out. I could have cheated and I could have passed, but I got high.
La da.
I'm
taking it next semester. And I know why, man, yeah, cause I got high. Because I got high, because I got high.
Go to the next.
I was gonna go to court before I got high. I was gonna pay my child support, but then I got high.
No, you wasn't.
They took my whole paycheck, and I know why.
Why, man?
Hey, because I got high, because I got high, because I got high. Gonna run from the cops, but I was high.
I'm serious, man.
I was gonna pull right over and stop,